Well, once again, Muslim terrorists slaughtered innocent
Islamic
people.
Extremists now control terrorists. Much of the country.
The rise
Their brand of
Islam
justice
Nazism.
Is brutal and deadly.
Newsflash, America. These Muslim extremists are alive and well. They are not dead. And their video is not gratuitous. And it certainly is not irrelevant. It is a warning.
Welcome to the Truth About Muslims podcast, the official podcast of the Zwemer Center for Muslim Studies, where we help to educate you beyond the media. Here are your hosts, Howard and Trevor.
All right, so I think we tend to believe that Muslims and Christians started interacting on 9/11, but reality is we've been interacting since the very beginnings of Islam in the 7th and 8th and 9th centuries. There's quite a robust relationship going on between Muslims and Christians, but it's not one. It's not a lot of history that we're aware of.
Right, that's something that I never learned in school.
Yeah. Not a whole lot of sermons preached about the days of John of Damascus.
The only thing I knew about Muslims, actually, now that I think about it, before 9/11, was being involved in missions work.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah. So I have a good friend, Dr. Daniel Janosik. He is an undergraduate degree in biology and English, and has an MDiv, and as well as a master's degree in Islamic studies or Muslim studies from the Zwemer Center. He also did his doctorate degree on John of Damascus. So,
wow, that's quite the gamut.
Yeah, so you know, he's the guy to ask, and so he gives sort of a background of this relatively unknown person in Christian history amongst most people. Unless you specifically studied this point in history, you wouldn't know much about him, and it's pretty interesting some of the things that he brings up.
Well, who was John of Damascus? It's a name from the past. It may bring some recollection of times in early Islam. But John had a great role to play in Islam. But there are also stories of John, of his demise and his trouble, his difficulties. One of these is when he got in trouble for going against the caliph, who was Abdul Malik at that time. And John was his right-hand man, and yet he was a Christian. And so this was perhaps a way to get back at the Christians at that time. But what happened was that there was supposedly a letter from a Christian leader from the Byzantine Empire who sent the letter to the caliph, Abdul Malik. And this letter implied that John of Damascus was plotting to assassinate the caliph. And so this was something that was very horrible in the eyes of the caliph. So he had his men bring in John of Damascus, accuse him of treachery, and they cut off his right hand and put him in jail. And then they were going to kill him after that. Well, when he was in prison, he asked for his hand to be brought back to him. And so they did that. And during that night, he prayed to the Virgin Mary that she would bring about a miracle and reattach his hand. And lo and behold, in the morning when they came to get him, his hand was reattached. It worked fine. And the miracle just amazed the people, and the caliph relented and realized that he must be mistaken, because this was an obvious miracle. Now, of course, this is folklore. That did not happen in John of Damascus, but this shows the honor and the respect and the memory of a man that in many ways gave us a picture of Islam in the early days.
All right, I think that that's probably folklore.
You know what? I was kind of wondering, like, why? Like, there was already the assumption there that this didn't happen. Is it because...
Well, that's what he said. He said, you know, that he thought it was folklore.
Yeah, I am just wondering myself. Like,
but I do I do feel you. That would be really a really cool story, a testimony to God.
Well, he did mention that the source of the story comes several, you know, decades, maybe hundreds of years later.
Afterward, right?
After. So there's some, yeah, it's a little skeptical.
Right.
Nevertheless, it's interesting to see the relationship that John of Damascus does have with the caliph of Islam, of the Islamic Empire, right there in the beginnings in Syria.
John lived in the first 100 years of Islam. He was actually born 675, died 750, gives you a place mark there. He worked under the caliph Abdul Malik, who reigned from 685 to 705. But John was the grandson of the man who apparently surrendered the city of Damascus to the forces of Islam when they came up in 635. So very early in the immigration of the Arabs to the north, the city was given over. So his grandfather was the mayor of the city of Damascus, and in order to save lives, he relented, surrendered the city. They had then relatively peaceful time for decades, and John's grandfather was restored to his position. He was called the Logothetes, which is kind of like the chief tax collector, especially for the Christians. And at first, the Christians were glad that the Arabs came in, because the Byzantines, who had been rulers before, had exacted pretty high taxes, and it was getting pretty onerous. So their new masters were much more easy on them in regard to the taxes. And these Arabs really lived outside in garrison towns, so that they did not bother the Christians so much at that time.
All right, so this show wouldn't be possible without sponsors.
And at this point in the show is where, if you want to partner with us, we would put your ad. So if you want to be a part of the show, you want to partner with us.
You like what we're doing.
You want to be on our team, what have you.
Bring this show to the world.
Then email us and let us know.
So when, maybe for context, for understanding, it's kind of like, it sounds similar to the New Testament, where you have Roman rule, but you also have the Jews living under Roman rule, and you had Jewish tax collectors that were essentially employed by the Roman Empire to collect taxes from the Jews living under the protection of Rome, Pax Romana. There's sort of this overarching political power structure that the Jews live under. So is that a good comparison? When Islam comes in to Damascus, they shift the power from Mecca to Damascus, and then the Christians live under a Islamic rule, but they still utilize Christian leaders to collect taxes and deal with their own people.
That's a very good analogy, in fact, because John's grandfather was that particular person to collect taxes in Damascus. And then when the empire settled there in Damascus, that was the central city, John's grandfather was still the chief tax collector. He gave that job off to his son, John's father. And then in time, probably around 700 AD under Abdul Malik, John of Damascus became the chief tax collector, the Logothetes, chief financial officer of the empire.
Yeah, I see how it's a lot like Rome and, of course, Israel at this time. But it also reminds me of Byzantine, what we kind of talked about last week.
Right, how the Byzantine Empire set up the sort of set the stage
system,
so that
right.
Islam could come in and fill that void.
Right, and then when they came in, they charged taxes. But maybe it was much less than what they were used to paying.
Right, and it's not like the Muslims were purely motivated. He does bring up an interesting point regarding why the Muslims needed to work with the Christians.
Well, from the sources that we have, John's family was in a lot of favor. They were a strong Christian family, a Melkite Orthodox Christian family. His father was a friend of the former caliph, and so they got along well. They were respected. They were needed at that time because all the record keeping, the financial record keeping, was in Greek, and so that is why they had favor with the Arabs. The Arabs needed them to maintain the status
of the whole empire, or the budding empire, because it was just coming into being at that time. So John was very much needed. He spoke Arabic. I mean, his actual name was John Mansur. Mansur is an Arab name. It means victor, victory.
Wow.
And so you usually know of him as John of Damascus, and yet he had that Arabic link. So he knew Arabic, he knew Syriac, because Syriac was the religious language of the church, and he was very good with Greek. He's known for his Greek writing. And so he had a very good education, and yet he was serving in the court of the caliph at that time and respected. And he seems to have respected Abdul Malik, who he was working for.
So, you know, in the beginning, it's actually a pretty good relationship between Muslims and Christians.
Right. They need each other, kind of, right? Because the rules and the laws, all that stuff is in Greek.
Yeah. John of Damascus speaks Arabic. He also can read and write in Greek.
Right. In Syriac, which is pretty, I don't even know what that is, but... That's pretty cool.
And but it doesn't always stay that way.
Shortly after John served, the language requirements changed. The Muslims had more control. They wanted to have the financial control. So they made it so that all the people in leadership, even if they were Christians, needed to know Arabic. Arabic became the official language.
Yeah, so it sounds like there was a really good relationship between John of Damascus and the caliph.
Right, but the problem is it's not going to remain that way. What started off well would not finish well as far as it goes between the relationship of the Muslims living in Damascus and John of Damascus.
I see some parallels with today when you have areas where there are... Well, there would be a large percentage of Christians or non-Muslims, and the Muslim population would be small at first. And then there's more of a congeniality, a working together. But as the Muslims develop more power and more influence and more population growth, there seems to be a change, and that seems to have happened in the early 700s. You have the governor of Iraq, Al-Hujjaj, who was a good friend of Abd al-Malik, coming in, and he made a lot of new proclamations. That's where Arabic became the official language, and there was more of a sense that they were putting pressure on the Christians for more taxes, and that's when the jizya, the so-called head tax, came into effect in the early 700s. So there was a change in the tenor of the government. The Arabs moved into the cities, they started taking control of the cities, and that's where you also had an exodus of Christians out of the area because they were being persecuted.
It sounds like when the Muslims started to change everything, that it was cutting out the Christian. Like they switched everything to the Arabic language, which made it so that they didn't actually need any of the Christians anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. The other perspective would be they set up a system that really favors their own people.
Right.
Which wouldn't be an inherently Muslim idea.
Right, that's a human thing, right?
It tends to be what we still do. We want to live in places with people like us and vote for people that will most benefit us, and that is a human issue, not necessarily one that's inherently Muslim.
Right.
It reminds me actually of the Exodus with Pharaoh and the Jews or the immigrant community living there. Remember how we were talking a few weeks back about immigration?
Right.
Immigration issues, when you start having these Christians living under the Islamic Empire, there's concerns about, well, why do we, they're not converting, you know, let's raise some taxes, let's cause life to be harder on them and shouldn't be as hard on us. I mean, this is our empire, we're providing the protection, this is an Islamic empire, not a Christian one, and so
right.
You see how that kind of happens.
And then eventually it's, you know, just like Daniel Danosik was saying, that the Christians start to leave.
Yeah, there's a mass exodus of Christians, but not all Christians. There's right. still those Nestorians that stick around.
So what happens to John of Damascus after all of this?
Well, eventually he leaves and he retires into a monastery where he begins doing a lot of his writing. And in the process of joining the monastery, there was an interesting story that Daniel shared about his first interactions with the abbot, or the sort of head monk of the monastery. It's very interesting.
When John decided to become a monk, he was set up in a monastery at St. Sabas, and the chief abbot appointed a strict master over him who really wanted to get John in line. John was known for his brilliance, his intellectual brilliance, and so this master monk decided to break him down. And so he wanted to have him do humiliating things, and one of those things was to take baskets and go into Damascus and sell these baskets as a representative of a poor trade. Well, John did that with a joyful heart. He went in, he took these baskets, and of course people looked down on him. But then one day there was a friend of his who was very wealthy and came and saw John's predicament and ended up giving him buying all the baskets, and John was able to go back and praise God for his good fortune. And in time, this master monk relented and gave John the benefit of the doubt and gave him better quarters and more freedom. The irony was that this master monk did not want John to write, and yet that was his great gift. And this is just an interesting story of the difficulties that he may have had in his early time.
So is that the end of the story? He just has this quaint little life in a monastery, and that's it?
Basically, no. No, it's here while he's living in the monastery that he writes his work, both his theological works for Orthodox Christianity and also really his polemics against what he would consider to be the heresy of the Ishmaelites. What are some of the differences that John really focuses in on that he would say that mm-hmm. this is a Christian heresy?
Okay. Well, first of all, you have the sense that the Arabs, the Muslims, did not accept the Trinity. At first, there was a difference. I mean, you have on the Dome of the Rock, which was built in the 690s by Abdul-Malik, the phrases, "Do not say three." In other words, don't talk about three gods, which, of course, the Christians never believed in three gods. But there were these admonitions against those types of ideas. Do not put Jesus Christ as God himself or the Son of God. So these ideas were becoming more and more prevalent in the time of Abdul-Malik, in the time of John of Damascus. And so when he went away to the monastery and wrote, we have a lot of works by John written in Greek, mostly his works on Orthodox Christianity, but also on two treatises where he talks about his time with Muslims, what he learned. One is called The Heresy, the Ishmaelites. He called them Ishmaelites. He never called them Muslims. He never referred to the Quran, though he does talk about the writings of Mahmed. He doesn't call him Muhammad, but he calls them Mahmed. And at that time, and this is about 743, he died in 750. So it's before before his death, as he's writing his big Orthodox faith, which is a composite of the 8 centuries of Christianity, where it seems like he's trying to leave something for the Christians so that they will not fall away from the faith. He sees that there are a lot of Christians who are going over and converting to Islam. Others are leaving the country. He stayed.
It's obvious that John of Damascus is writing with a certain audience in mind.
Right. I mean, people, as he's getting ready to point out, are leaving Christianity for Islam. And so he's having to give a credible defense for a reason to stay in the faith.
He said that Muhammad or Mohammed was a false prophet and the religion was one of coercion and that it was leading to the Antichrist. Not that it was the Antichrist, but it had the hallmark of the Antichrist. And so he saw difficulties. One of those was that they denied the Trinity. Another was that they denied the deity of Christ. They saw him as a prophet. They had great respect for him. And that's where it seems like the early movement that became Islam came out of a respect for Christ, but a deficient view of Christ. And then they also came up with the view that the Bible was corrupted. You even see that in the writings of John, where he felt like they would not accept certain things that he would say biblically because of their views of the Christian scriptures.
So, I don't know, today in our language we don't really come down on heretics like that. And so with the way John of Damascus spoke, it's kind of startling a little bit.
Yeah, it seems a bit harsh at first glance.
I mean, I get it. In this time of, you know, this day and age, or at this time when he's writing, you know, it would be very, you know, he would be very cutting to heretics or people he perceived to be heretics.
And he would have to give a credible defense of the faith while discrediting Islam, and that's what he does in his writings.
And he was writing primarily to the church. This wasn't really for Muslims. He's not entering a debate with them.
You know, I think that's one of the things that I've always wondered about John of Damascus. I'm not sure that this is meant to be an evangelistic strategy. Sometimes we think of apologetics and evangelism.
It's one and the same.
Yeah, and I think John of Damascus has a particular audience in mind, and that is Christians that are wondering, should I stay within the Christian faith or should I convert to Islam?
From Truth About Muslims podcast. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we want you to read an ad for us. Can you do that? You'll be famous, like world famous. It'll be amazing.
CIU.
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 I'm Kevin Kakaisen.
Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin.
Oh, wow. Nice. He just
Luke
lied.
Luke Finn.
Luke.
All right.
CIU educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
You want to read that again?
Yeah.
You're like, I'll be so embarrassed if you read that out
there. I mean, it's fascinating to sit and ask questions of somebody that's dedicated a good portion of their life to looking at one individual, John of Damascus, and his early interactions with the Muslims there in Damascus, Syria.
Right. And it seems like it's starting to cross pertinence for us because today we're dealing with some of these things like people converting both ways. Right. And then, of course, refugees, you know, and then, to power changing, people losing favor, people becoming secondary citizens. Right. Mm-hmm. We have that happening in the Muslim world at this moment.
We have that happening in the Muslim world where Christians are being driven out by radicals.
Yep.
We have it happening in the Western world where Muslims are looking for refuge and to be treated with justice and mercy. And because they're Muslim, some people don't want to.
Right.
The irony behind all of this is that we are still talking about the same place, Syria.
Yeah. And this is Damascus, right?
And so one of the questions that, you know, I had to ask was, so how, what would John of Damascus say to us as Christians today watching what's happening in the world? And would John of Damascus have relevant words for us?
Well, I think this is a great opportunity. Muslims are coming to us. They want, they have a lot of questions. They're questioning their own beliefs. They're seeing what ISIS is doing and realizing that that is Islamic. They're following the Quran, and yet they're having second thoughts. So this is a time, a great opportunity for Christians to really show the love of Christ, to reach out to these refugees and see this as perhaps a way that God is breaking down the walls, as he has in so many Muslim countries already, with the dreams and the visions and the miraculous things that are happening. I mean, God is on the move. And this may be another way that God is moving and opening us to the opportunities. We can see from the life of John how things changed even during his lifetime. Early on, when the Arabs came in, they took over Damascus, there was a sharing of responsibilities. There was a respect for the Christians, a need for the Christians, because they spoke Greek, they took care of the economic, financial matters. But as time went on, the persecution grew. And that's why I think that John decided to give up his life as a civil servant. He knew Arabic, so he could have continued in that service. But around 715, 717, he decided to go off to the monastery, became a priest in Damascus under a very famous priest there, and then moved off to St. Sabas, a monastery outside of Jerusalem. And he had a friend who was a monk there in Damascus. And this friend just got to the point of rebelling against Islam. And so he went out into the square and proclaimed blasphemy against Muhammad, against Islam. And of course, he was taken captive. His tongue was cut out. He was beat to a pulp and then turned loose, exiled. But he didn't survive very many days. And I think John took that very deeply. It was something that affected him, and you find that in some of his writings. But that's what was going on. And so he wrote in Greek, and he wrote against Islam in his later years, the heresy of the Ishmaelites, another dialogue, the disputation between a Christian and a Saracen. And these were apologetic treatises. They brought out the differences between Christianity and Islam. And he had great insight into what was going on, but he also saw that these were troubled times. It was not what started off in the early days.
Yeah, I like how he says that these are huge opportunities, that God is at work in using the wrath of man to praise him and moving peoples all over the world, and particularly Muslims, into areas where they might hear the gospel.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we talked about with the refugee episode.
Mm-hmm.
It is an amazing opportunity. And, you know, talking with Daniel Janosik was really cool about the him, you know, knowing so much about John of Damascus. It's encouraging that he would say that this is what John of Damascus would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because for me, when I look back on history, sometimes I think that maybe other people didn't have that perspective of reaching people with the gospel at, you know, no matter the cost, no matter the circumstance, looking above and beyond what seems like in the natural. But here we go. I mean, this is Daniel Janosik, who's an expert on John of Damascus, and I thought that was pretty encouraging.
Yeah, and he's also, he gives a little bit more that we're going to have to put into another episode regarding the Trinity.
Mm.
And so he gives a nice explanation of John of Damascus, how he would argue and defend the Trinitarian beliefs of Christianity. And also goes on to explain sort of the basis of apologetics. But we're going to have to put that into another episode.
Well, thanks for listening this week. Again, iTunes, we have a lot so far, but we would love to see more and more. It makes a difference, right, Trevor?
Oh, absolutely. It helps us know that people are listening.
Yeah.
I mean, it may just be the 38 people that have left reviews listening, and we love those 38 people, but...
that's why we do it.
It is a lot of work, and it's almost been a year, so we will do our one-year anniversary show here in a few weeks, and...
what are we doing?
I don't know. That may be the last show of our... existence. We may just wrap it up in a year. So we're still in Islam 101, 101 episodes of Islam.
Yeah, I don't know why you keep saying that.
All right.
We'll see you next week.